You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Danny LaRue, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. I got into a little bit of a conundrum with how to handle the end of this week because the Warriors have games on Thursday and Friday, and then also the huge Christmas Day game against Cleveland. And what I ended up deciding to do is basically taking two podcasts and stitching them together. So I ended up watching Warriors Nets a little bit late because I did the Twitter show. This is coming out after the morning commute for people, but that's fine. And so I want to talk about that game and give it a little bit of attention and time because I found it a particularly fascinating one for the Warriors this season. And also have a preview of the big Christmas Day game. Chris Manning, who does Locked On Cavs, writes for Fear the Sword. He and I did a crossover podcast, which usually would be its own standalone because it's more than half an hour. But I figured the best way to put all of this together so that it would be listenable and so that it wasn't kind of podcast on podcast on podcast was to just make it one bigger episode. So it's a lot of fun to kind of have those two things together. And this episode is brought to you by SeatGeek. It is a great way to buy and sell tickets to concerts, to sporting events, Warriors games, whatever you want. And you can download the free SeatGeek app. And if you use the promo code LOWarriors, you get a $20 rebate on your first purchase. They just basically give you $20 back. It's pretty awesome. And we'll talk about that more a little bit later. But I found this Warriors game absolutely fascinating. And one of the big reasons why, beyond Draymond Green missing the game due to the birth of his first child, his son, congratulations to Green and the Green family, was because it was the first time really this year where they had a game where things started poorly and then they came back. It was a real staple of the 73-win season was the Warriors just being able to come back from basically any deficit. I was thinking about that Clippers game earlier this week, which I think was about a year ago now. Might have been about a little bit before that, where they were basically down the whole game, and I think they were down 15 in the fourth quarter and went to the death lineup and just completely demolished the Clippers. That hasn't really happened much this year. The games that the Warriors have started poorly off the top, like when I went through it, were really the biggest ones were the Spurs game, the Lakers game, and the Grizzlies game. And this commonality between those is they lost all three of those games. The Lakers, they shot poorly, stayed shooting poorly, just kind of lost it. Memphis, they never really got back into it, and then it was also the first game of back-to-back. So that was kind of what the Memphis game is actually probably what I was kind of thinking during that. But one of the big differences with this and some of the other ones, first of all, the Nets just actively are not good. And also, there were a lot of unsustainable elements in it that looked like they were potentially turning even during the game itself. So one crazy stat I dug up while I was working on this and the piece for The Athletic was Brooklyn shot 9 for 20 from 3 in the first half, which is absolutely incredible. It's it happens sometimes, and they're a team that shoots. They have one of the highest three-point attempt rates in the league. It's one of the things that Coach Kenny Atkinson has done with this team, and Brook Lopez is shooting a ton of them too. The Warriors shot an identical 9 for 20 in the restricted area, and not only is that fewer points because it's 2s versus 3s, but the restricted area is where any team is supposed to get their most reliable shots, and Durant was 0 for 4 in that first half in the restricted area. That's not something you ever really expect from him. And so when I was watching it, you're kind of sitting there going, well, this is going to go one of two ways relatively quickly. Either the struggles the Warriors had, they also had 10 turnovers in the first half, either that's going to continue and it's going to get out of hand really quickly and the Nets are going to believe and they're going to do it, or the Warriors are going to just realize where they are and just kind of handle it. And we went down the ladder path really, really quickly. Durant got that big and one off the steal, right on Brook Lopez's head. It's the second big, maybe even the third big dunk on Brook Lopez in the very recent past. But they did that. And then also it was the Warriors cut the lead from 16 to 4 before Brooklyn had their first points of the half. They forced 6 turnovers during that stretch, so just between the start of the half and Brooklyn's first make, which was a Brook Lopez driving layup. And a lot of that was Kevin Durant. Durant was great in this game, and particularly in the second half. It was kind of a hybrid defensive game for him. There were certain moments, like he had a nice strip on Brook Lopez and a couple of good reads where he just kind of got in the way that looked more like Draymond Green. But his weak side play was more reminiscent of what he did in the playoffs last year when he was huge in the Spurs series and then, of course, against the Warriors in the first four games of that Western Conference Finals. And then offensively, he was a little bit more assertive. He kind of found his place offensively, but also was great in transition, which is something that he is just so dominant in, because he's hard enough to defend when everyone's on a, when everyone's kind of keeping their eyes on him. But in transition, there's a lot going on in terms that you have to keep a track of, especially when the Warriors have Steph and Klay on the floor. They didn't have Draymond in this game, so you didn't have to worry about that. And Durant was able to get to the basket on some of those. He was able to get a pull-up that he's so comfortable with and get to the line a little bit. And so Durant in this game was closer to what I expect to see in the playoffs and later on, and was likely probably keyed by just what happened earlier in the game, that, you know, they just didn't have that fire, they didn't have that, and Draymond Green is often the player who initiates that realization and initiates that recovery, and so somebody else had to take on the mantle. Also, Klay Thompson was huge in that third quarter, 4-for-7 for 11 points, but also 3-of-4 from 3, and while he wasn't the disruptor that Durant was defensively, you still need players to capitalize on the open looks that are generated by your offense, and Klay Thompson is excellent at that. So Klay played a really significant role in converting those, especially on a day where a lot of guys had good games but didn't have those kind of offensively great games. Zaza Pachulia also played well during that stretch. It wasn't really, you know, it's one of those games where his plus minus was belied, you know, his contribution, just because he was on the floor for that absolute demolition. But he still did a nice job of being in the right place at the right time, contesting some Brook Lopez plays, and actually finishing some plays. He did a nice job in that third quarter. He had two finishes and also had an assist. And also, Kevon Looney had two assists in that third quarter, was moving the ball well, and it takes him a little bit. Looney, I would credit him for his patience, that he doesn't rush with the ball in his hands, because that's the biggest criticism a lot of times of young guys. He certainly doesn't do that. And Looney's getting better at making the right decision at the right time. He actually ended up with 5 assists in the whole game, which is pretty impressive. But they need something a little bit, you know, they need something a little bit different. He's not Draymond Green, but at the same time, when Draymond's completely out, the Warriors don't have enough wings, unless they're going to go with some of those Clark-McCaw combo lineups, to really play Durant at the four all that much, because you kind of need to balance it out. And so they did a couple of different things in this game. One, they played Looney almost 20 minutes. I think it was at like 18. And for really the first time I can remember this year, they played David West at power forward. And generally speaking, it looked good. I have thought that West at power forward made some sense because, yeah, he has the advantage as a center of stretching out the other team center because he's so comfortable shooting from 18 feet, but he's not really much of a rim protector. He is a solid help defender. He's had some great defensive stretches, including that Minnesota game, but the Warriors were just more stout. They played him with JaVale in the first quarter and then with Zaza in the third, and both times the team looked good. So I wonder if we'll see a little bit more of that. When Draymond and Durant are healthy, you don't need too much, but you might as well. And also, those guys, McGee, Pachulia, but more importantly, McGee and West, aren't playing so many minutes overall that you're sitting there going, oh, you don't want to tax them by playing them more together or something like that. No, they can play plenty more, and you can give Green and Durant a little bit more rest. And I hope Kerr feels more comfortable with those lineups, and presumably a little bit less comfortable with Anderson Varejao. Another shaky performance from him. He had one of those plays, I talked about this in my piece for The Athletic, that I just absolutely hate, which is gunning for an offensive rebound that you have no chance of getting. And then when you do that, basically what happens is you're pushing towards the basket, and generally speaking, that is done by the slowest guy on your team, often the slowest guy on the court, and oftentimes the other team will get a clean look. They're at least 5-on-4, sometimes they're even more than that, before the guy who went for the offensive rebound gets back. That's what happened on that play. Drives me absolutely insane. Drives me insane when Varejao does it. Drives me insane when everyone does it. So something to watch for. Pachulia every once in a while catches himself in that, but he's gotten better. He often is in a kind of a different context. He's not really crashing in for the offensive rebound. He's more there trying to position himself. And that's not nearly as bad, because you're already there. You're trying to make the advantage of the position that you work to create, as opposed to just doing it the way that he does. So the Warriors, what I took away from this game was that they really can flip the switch sometimes. It helps a lot that, you know, the Nets aren't the greatest team, though I will note that they've been substantially better since they got Jeremy Lin back, when they're close to their full complement. Bogdanovich was playing really well in the first half, in the first quarter, actually, and then really fell off the map. Some of that was due to better defense. He actually had 10 points in the first half, or in the first quarter, and then 2 points in the rest of the game. Brook Lopez was great. Lin was solid, former Warrior Jeremy Lin, but they just don't have enough talent to do that. And so I'm not sure that the Warriors can pull off this rough performance for a first half and then just turn it around and win the game going away, which is really what happened here very often. It is useful for them that they can, but that can't really be something they can fall back on too often. However, getting a win on the road against an opponent that was playing well, especially for the first half, without Draymond Green is certainly significant in and of itself. I would say it's more significant than their other win without Draymond, the Minnesota one, because in the Minnesota game, the Wolves were just off, and the Warriors played well. Looney did a nice job. Everyone did there, but you want to see that. And another part of the context, I'm not as concerned about this as some people, but you could think about what happened on Thursday night. So the Warriors are trailing by 16 to the Nets. And, you know, it's one of those, everybody has a couple of rough road games over the course of the season, basically a couple often per month. And at the same time, the Spurs were facing the Clippers. Spurs were playing well. And then eventually Chris Paul left the game due to a left hamstring strain. And so you're sitting there going, okay, so the Warriors are going to lose a game, Spurs are going to win a game, and so they'll bounce back and forth, and the Spurs are the closest team to the Warriors, both in the West and overall. Warriors end up winning, Spurs end up losing. And so that is a reminder of why it's going to be very hard to be ahead of the Warriors at the end of the regular season, because they have enough talent to win games when they're not playing super well, and they have enough talent to just basically to kind of overpower certain teams, even whether they're playing well or not. Just no chance games for the other squad. Thinking back to like the Clay game against Indiana or various ones like that. The Spurs are very good. They're a good regular season team. They will be a threat later on. But as a regular season squad, this year's team is not the same as last year's because they don't have that defensive foundation with Tim Duncan and Kawhi. And also their offense can be a little bit finicky. I actually watched that game for the Twitter NBA show. So of course, the Warriors, if they kind of fall off the pace themselves, they can be caught. But I think that's going to be the way it happens, not that somebody like San Antonio just rattles off like 68 or 65 wins. I think if the Warriors can kind of stick in that range themselves, they'll be fine. And another kind of situation that will test that idea is the game on Friday night against the Detroit Pistons. The Pistons are a talented team. They have some really good defensive players. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope has done a great job in the past on Steph Curry, and now they have Reggie Jackson back, so you can actually credibly do that because Ish Smith cannot guard Clay. So we'll see if the Warriors can win that on a back-to-back. Presumably it's going to be without Draymond Green as I'm recording this. I haven't heard anything definitive, but it would be surprising to see him back considering the travel that would take place with that. And I know he would love to play in the closest he can get to a hometown game considering he's from Saginaw, but the birth of your child is more important, and I'm sure he'll want to play on Christmas. So you get a couple days and then you fly out on the 24th and make that all happen. And if he wants to take more time off, you're not going to hear a hot take from me about how the Warriors need Draymond Green for regular season games to prove anything. So if you want that, you can go elsewhere. I don't know where you can go, but you can go elsewhere. And before getting into the Cavs preview, both of these games, the Nets game that we saw yesterday, and then of course the huge Christmas Day game, are great examples of why it's fun to go to a live sporting event. You get the feel of the arena. You get, if you're a Warriors fan who lives in another place, that is a great experience too, because you get that mix of like the home crowd, the loyal partisans who are hoping that their team does what the Nets did in the first half and gives the behemoth, the monolith, the fight of their lives. And then you have the Warriors fans that are in the arena. And I don't really need to sell people who are in the Bay Area on how to go to Oracle. I've been covering games since 2009. I actually had a partial season ticket plan the year before that. And it's an amazing experience, has been, will be. So one of the ways that you can go to a game is with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is an amazing way to buy and sell tickets. There are a lot of reasons why I like it personally, and I know the ticket business well. I used to actually buy and sell tickets to make a living, and SeatGeek has a couple of big major positives. One is that they're an aggregator, so there are a lot of different places that you can buy tickets, and SeatGeek pulls a lot of them together, and so you really only have to look in one place. And that feeling is really good. It's kind of like Kayak, which is what I often use to book my plane flights, where you don't have to worry about, oh, well, what about this one? What about that one? It puts it all together. And also, the other way they put it together is with the deal score. And different arenas have different quality of seats in various places. And while I have enough arrogance to believe that I can do a better job than a computer, especially for arenas that I do well. I found when I was using SeatGeek to buy tickets for myself, to buy tickets for my family, even in arenas I knew, I would use their deal score, which is a combination of the ticket quality and the price. I found that I agreed with them almost the whole time. And that's really impressive. And so I did that a lot with Giants games, actually. Like, it did a great job of identifying, hey, these are good tickets. So you can use the deal score, find it, and say, hey, that's a good value. Use it for sporting events, use it for concerts, whatever else you want. And if you download their free SeatGeek app, use the promo code under the settings tab, LO Warriors, so like Locked On Warriors, LO Warriors, you get a $20 rebate on your first purchase. So you get $23, you get to use a great app that I personally use all the time when I need to buy tickets to anything. And you get to support the show too, because using the LO Warriors code tells them that you came from us. So I hope you use it. I really do personally enjoy SeatGeek. And now let's talk a little bit about Cavs Warriors with Chris Manning of Locked On Cavs. So we're a couple of days away right now from the big Christmas Day game, but of course it's looming large on both teams' calendars. So where do you want to start with this? I mean, there are a lot of different things to discuss. These teams haven't faced each other since Game 7 of the NBA Finals.
Yeah, I mean, you could pick a ton of different places, right? I mean, you could talk about how the Cavs are going to defend Durant. You could talk about how if the Warriors are better off this year or worse in certain ways than last year defensively, which I think they're probably better. But I think the thing to me that's the most interesting about this game that I can't figure out, and that maybe you can answer better than me, is what the heck is Kevin Love going to do in this game? Like, he's been really good so far this year, right? But he doesn't exactly have obvious ways to succeed in this game. He certainly will probably do well offensively. I think you can post him up against a lot of different lineups. You can do useful things with him. But I don't know who he defends when the Warriors go small. Is he playable in those situations? I don't know. I think against the starting lineup, you probably have to have him defend Zaza. Or if JaVale's on the floor, you have him defend JaVale. But if the Warriors go small, I don't know if you can play Kevin Love. And that's kind of a problem.
They'll probably just put him on Iguodala. It's not a perfect solution, but in this kind of a context, you kind of might as well. But yeah, it's weird because these teams, the Cavs are in many ways similar to what they were last year, except for JR being out with this thumb issue. The Warriors are substantially different. You know, this is a team that the structure is not that different just because they play a center, then they pull a center, play some small lineups and all that kind of stuff. But Kevin Durant, Harrison Barnes is a pretty significant change. And then a lot of the bench guys are very different and the sub pattern is very different. So with Love, I'm guessing they'll try to use him to attack switches offensively. It's something that he can do well. It's actually one of his bigger strengths beyond just when his shot is on. Of course, that's wonderful. But defensively, you're right. It will be a problem for them when the Warriors play small. But I don't think they're going to go small that often in this game.
What makes you say they're not going to go that small in this game?
Kerr hasn't really used it that much. It's been a show of respect. Periodically, he goes to it in the regular season, like particularly this year, at the end of the first quarter, but usually it's the end of the second, and then if the game is still close, the end of the fourth quarter. But throughout this kind of run, the title last year, the Western Conference and the finals last year, various people involved, especially Draymond Green and Kerr himself, have said that playing Draymond at center is more physically taxing on him. And that makes sense. I mean, when you think about
what
you're asking him to do. And partially due to what happened last year and LeBron and a million other things, the Warriors aren't prioritizing the regular season in the same way as last year. So they are not at the point where they're just like punting games. That's just not what they're doing. But they are not pushing full bore really at all. And actually, one of the elements of this game that I'm most excited for is to see whether those general norms from this regular season are applicable to this game, or if they just treat it differently because of all the history.
Yeah, I think on both sides there are certainly ways that I think it might make sense for the norms to be different, right? Like, I think the Cavs, they're around 15th defensively. They've been lower than that this year in terms of defensive efficiency. I could see them playing harder on defense in this game and putting in more of an effort. Like, I think structurally they have issues defensively that are going to keep them from maybe being as good of a defense as they were last year. Certainly no rim protection or ideal rim protection is an issue, but I think you could see more of a defensive effort in this game. I think they're going to have issues, of course. Like, Kyrie is going to probably struggle defensively in this game, although he was passable in the finals when he played with a lot of effort, and he doesn't always play with a lot of effort on that end. And there's just these little things in this game that I really want to see. I think the Iguodala and Love thing is really interesting because I want to kind of see how that plays out, because we can't put too much stock into a regular season game, because we saw that last year that some of that doesn't matter, goes out the window when the playoffs come. And if the Warriors would probably – you would probably guess that they would use their small lineup more in June than they would now, because if you need to go to in a game seven, you're just going to go to in a game seven if it's going to win you the title. These little things like Kevin Love guarding Andre Iguodala, can the Warriors make him pay in space like that? And can Iggy do that for five possessions, you know, in a short span, or even just three possessions in enough span, where Tyronn Lue goes away from Love and takes away a guy who's been the Cavs' second best player this year, in my opinion, off the floor? I think those little things are just going to be kind of fascinating.
My biggest question for this is just, will LeBron care? What is his approach going to be to this game? Because there are kind of traps either way. You know, if he takes it seriously and they lose, then that's not the greatest thing in the world. It's also not a big deal. But if he takes it a little bit looser and the Warriors win, so I'm legitimately unsure. And why it matters more for LeBron than the Warriors is that some of the Warriors are going to care. Like Draymond Green is going to be out there playing 100%. But from what I can tell, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, LeBron is more of a tone setter than anything. Like that's one of the key roles that he has on this Cavs team. And some of the more lax games that they've had have been kind of keyed by him in that way.
You're 100% correct. I think if you look at the Cavs, they just played the Bucks, and normally, and I think you've hit on this too, and you've talked to Nate Duncan on that pod, they struggle when LeBron goes off the floor, and that makes sense because he's LeBron freaking James, and you're of course going to struggle when he goes off the floor. It was a big, big moment for this team when Kyrie scored a bunch of points in a row and extended the lead when LeBron left the court at the end of the third quarter against the Bucks on Wednesday. It wasn't a long stretch. It was a minute and 19 seconds, but it mattered because you saw them finish really strong without him on the floor, and they fed off that too. But you're right. LeBron is the trendsetter. He sets the tone when they talk about opponents. I mean, there's guys last night that were talking about the Bucks as someone they might want to see in the playoffs. Kyrie in particular seems very interested in taking on the Bucks again. LeBron's like, they're the Bucks, you know, like there are bigger things for us out there. And I think you're right, but I do think he has his eye on this game. I think he loves the competition, but I don't think you'd see the finals LeBron. And it doesn't make sense to see finals LeBron, him trying to go all out like that in this game. It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't. There's not much to be gained from doing that. But you do see a fundamental difference. I saw this in the Warriors in the game they played against the Blazers earlier this week, where you can tell when a team has a game circled, and whether that is for a legitimate reason or just for whatever reason, they play a little bit differently. But a lot of times that can be how it starts, but not necessarily how it finishes. So maybe the first quarter and the fourth quarter are intense, and then it's just kind of lax during the middle. I legitimately don't know. And it's also hard. I mean, the two of us cover the teams this year that I would say the regular season is probably of good teams. The regular season is the least important for. So I'm sitting there going, yeah, this is significant on paper. It's absolutely significant depending on what happens for these two teams. But I do not know if the teams are going to approach it that way, or if it's going to be a disparity between the two, because it's possible either way that one of these teams takes the Christmas Day game much more seriously than the other.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with the Cavs, this is the first game I feel like they've been really revved up for this year. I don't think they really got up for that Clippers game that they had where they lost. That was for a couple different reasons. I don't think they've gotten up for the Toronto games. I think they liked going to Milwaukee this week and beating the Bucks after kind of getting beat down by them the last time around. I think they enjoyed winning that game, especially I think Kyrie again like really enjoyed kind of getting that win back. But yeah, I think this is the Cavs' like first game this year where I feel like a lot of guys are going to get really up for it. The JR thing certainly impacts it a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go with you. Is Shumpert going to be the guy who takes advantage of this, or how?
Well, see, Liggins starts, and that to me that makes sense because Ty Lue is going for the keep the bench the same. You want to keep those rotations in the same because JR, it's not like JR is out for the year and you have to restructure your rotation. You're going to give him on Shumpert more minutes, but you're going to start Liggins, keep Shumpert coming off the bench, especially because they don't have a Mario Chalmers or a traditional point guard to fill those minutes that Shumpert's really filling right now and sort of the role he's filling right now. I don't know. The JR thing is interesting because I could see the Cavs kind of being like, okay, like we know we're not at full strength. I think in their heads, they know they're not the same without JR. I mean, we saw this against the first game they had him without the Bucks. Kyrie is making more of an effort to drive into the lane where I think he might have shot and settles for a mid-range shot in that game when he knows there's not as much shooting outside. I think you're going to see that. But I think in some way the atmosphere of that game, at least for a quarter, if it goes one way or another in the first quarter, maybe that dictates things. But I think that atmosphere is really going to amp everybody up. I know specifically, I don't know if you've ever seen the Cavs' pregame intro.
I have.
There's one part of it that they have not edited out this year, and that is LeBron James kind of elbowing Curry from the finals. The Cavs, just on Thursday night, they had a thing where they had one of their in-game crew members get pied in the face by Moondog, and the person that got pied in the face was wearing Warrior stuff. It was like on a mock kiss cam. They're going to play this up, I think. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if you see more finals highlights, if you see more stuff from the Warriors, you know, losing and like all the stuff that went wrong for them in the finals and playing it up. If just knowing the Warriors and specifically knowing Draymond Green, I expect that first quarter to be very, very intense. Where it goes from there to me is interesting because if, let's say, the Warriors get out to a 12-point lead, do the Cavs take their foot off the pedal? If the Cavs get up, do the Warriors say, okay, like, we don't really need to win this one today? Or does one of the teams decide, okay, we're making a big statement today? And then in the end, like, how much does it actually matter? You know, like, it's so hard to figure out how much it actually matters and then predict where the little nuances are going to come in terms of the effort level, because, like, you would think from a fan perspective and someone who's just going to watch this game, this is the game you circle on your calendar on Christmas Day to probably watch. It's the two biggest teams. It's the three biggest stars in the league. And yet it could be something that isn't living up to those expectations.
It's the peril of an NBA regular season game, especially among two good teams. I remember last year, the Warriors and Spurs, they decided to put two of their games in like the last week and a half of the season. And both of them were disappointing for various reasons, just because those teams didn't really have, they had something to play for, but not a ton at that point. Something I wanted to ask you is, the Warriors have changed up their rotations this year due to Durant and everything else that's going on. And they've been playing Durant. He gets the early pull, and then he comes back late in the first, but then he gets that run at the beginning of the second quarter, which, from what I remember, is actually closer to what LeBron has done the last few years. Not in terms of the early pull, but in terms of starting the second quarter. Is that still true, or are they kind of messing with that a little bit because of all the JR thing and a couple other elements of this team?
I think it's similar to what we've seen in the past. I mean, you're still seeing Kyrie kind of lead things on his own. We're still seeing LeBron kind of take things on his own. The one thing that I think is different that has thrown the rotations as we kind of have known them the past 2 years is Kevin Love. We're seeing him play more with bench units, and it's not always ideal lineups. I think sometimes we've seen, like a couple weeks ago, we saw him play with a lineup of Thompson, Liggins, Shumpert, and J.R. Smith. There was not one person on the floor that I felt comfortable feeding him the ball in the post. Like, that's not ideal. But you're seeing him play with bench units. You're seeing him play with in situations where last year, and it's not a full switch from what they did, especially in the playoffs, but you're seeing him play with those bench units. And I kind of wonder how that's going to match up with the Warriors do, because I think if you're the Cavs, you want to probably play Kevin Love maybe at the five against JaVale. Like, maybe you want to play, you know, you want to, they don't use it very often because it's a horrible defensive pairing, but maybe you want to go to Fry and Love at the same time when the Warriors have JaVale and or whoever on the floor. You want to try to pull them out of the paint and make it harder on them to protect the rim for guys. I don't really know exactly what they'll do, because Lou isn't a guy who exactly sticks to patterns. He very much goes on feel. Sometimes we will see guys play that we haven't seen play in a week. Jordan McRae played on Thursday, and he has barely played this year, and he played about, I think, almost 10 minutes that game. You will just see things that you don't expect almost every night, and I think maybe against the Warriors, you might see that, especially because if Liggins plays really badly, maybe you see 30, 35 minutes of him on Shumpert, because he just can't trust Liggins to play well in a close game.
The same general thing is often true with the Warriors. Like, they have this rock solid part of their rotation, and it's solidifying a little bit more as players like Ian Clark and JaVale are settling into roles and playing well enough to earn more consistent roles. But Kerr also has a penchant, especially in the regular season, though it was also true in the playoffs later on, to play guys basically if they haven't gotten run in a while or some sort of reason. And so I feel like we're going to get some Anderson Varejão minutes in this game. Not a lot.
Oh boy.
But a little bit.
Oh boy.
And that would be interesting. Let's put it that way. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because I was surprised, stunned maybe even, that Varejão did not get a positive reception in Cleveland during the finals, because my interpretation from the Cavs end, or from the Cavs fans end, of what happened was that Varejao just got traded because they wanted to get Channing Frye, and he got kind of booed when he came back. And maybe some of that was just because he was playing for the team that had beaten them for the title and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, I didn't understand. While there are many reasons to be dissatisfied with Anderson Varejao right now, it didn't seem like a lot of those were from Cleveland's end.
Yeah, I know. I think you hit it on the head. I think the important thing there to know is they were not really pleased that he went to Golden State. And I also think, wasn't there something in the finals before he got back to Cleveland where he had, like, bumped somebody or, you know, like, kind of dusted up with one of the Cavs? And I think that kind of turned him into a heel. The heel turn came really fast. Like, it went from him being – he's still beloved. Like, I guarantee you if he went to any restaurant in Cleveland today, you know, and he wasn't in town with the Warriors, like, they would give him a free meal. And he's still insanely popular. I always count Varejao and Delly jerseys when I go to games. He had four last night. Wednesday when I went. And he had all these people in Varejao stuff. You still see the wigs from time to time. And I think maybe it was the just him playing for the Warriors and him. I really do think he might have bumped somebody because he's Anderson Varejao. And, like, what else does Anderson Varejao do besides kind of get in people's faces and kind of create some uncomfortable situations for people?
That certainly sounds possible. I legitimately don't remember, but it's entirely knowing AV and having followed him for a long time, it's totally possible that there was something like that. And those are the types of moments that have that fans remember maybe more than players. You know, Varejao just gets involved in physical stuff constantly because when
he's like the nicest guy. The nicest guy.
But especially when a guy flops a lot, like that's something that fans remember that, and you see that all over. I think we're starting to see a little bit of that with Marcus Smart. Like fans remember they see him like jumping around like a fish at various moments, and they go, "Oh, I'm gonna boo that guy," and things like that. And so, and also if you're watching on TV, it's a lot easier to notice that because they because sometimes they show repeat camera angles and all that sort of thing. And so
I think the Vine aspect of it too. It's like if someone does an insane flop or does something crazy, it's getting Vine, it's getting shared across. Like whatever a bajillion social channels, websites and blogs are sharing content. And like Marcus Smart, it's like, I feel like if you Google him most of the time, there's never like a Marcus Smart had a really good dunk or Marcus Smart had this crazy assist. It's like Marcus Smart just faked his own death and like flopped on the floor trying to draw a foul call. Like that's what he does.
Yeah, that's certainly fair. One thing I also wanted to talk about with Shump is I get what you're saying, and from what I've seen, it's completely right about the way that they're kind of striking his balance is that 2 years ago, well, a year and a half ago, if we're going to be accurate, he had a lot of the, you know, tough defensive assignments against the Warriors. He was on Clay periodically. He gets switched on to Steph, and especially, you know, with all the weird stuff with Kyrie getting hurt in game one of that series. And I would love to see that again, like just from a basketball perspective, but I understand why his greater need is actually to fill that second unit thing, which is something that Lou has had a better sense of than a lot of coaches, of the idea of, the part of the reason you want to do that with Liggins, why you want to have him up there, is because he can't do what Shump can do on those LeBron, no Kyrie lineups.
Yeah, and he's not, and it's not even that Shumpert's a good creator by any means, right? Like, I mean, he's playing out of his mind by his standards this year. Like, he's shooting still really well. He's not turning the ball over every time he dribbles, but he's competent. And with you look at DeAndre Liggins, every time he creates, it's like watching Amon Shumpert from last year when he was playing maybe the worst year of his career, and he's just going to turn the ball over. When he gets the ball on offense, unless he's wide open, he almost always passes it. And that's kind of interesting, too. Like, what do the Warriors do defensively? I mean, I would guess you probably put Clay on Kyrie. You would probably maybe put Steph on Liggins. Is that probably what you think they would do?
Yes, presumably. And we'll see how much the Cavs try to make him switch back. But they could do that. But also, since it's a regular season game, maybe you keep Steph happy. He likes the point guard assignments. It was something he actually chafed at Mark Jackson a little bit about, just because I think it was more not because of the way that the assignments were doled out, but it kind of came with this implication of like, oh, you can't do it. And he didn't like that. But in the playoffs, that's what I would think they'd go to. But, you know, it's weird. Kerr surprises me sometimes with that. So I think they're going to do a mix of the two. They'll probably give Curry the assignment. And then if he struggles, they switch it back.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm interested in. I do think the Cavs will put Love on the center, whoever it is.
Yeah,
I think having him defend Draymond Green sounds like you're asking to get pick and rolled with like KD and Draymond or Steph and Draymond until death happens.
Well, and how much is LeBron going to engage? Because now LeBron, you know, they had LeBron on Draymond. It was one of the things that really did swing the series. And doing that this year is very, very different. And so,
oh, it's completely different.
I'm gonna be interested because this is the first real test we've seen of that. And it's not so much how he defends. That I don't care as much about now just because it's a regular season game and everything like that. But how they set the matchups, how they set kind of the schemes, those can be nice indicators of where this is going to go, because it's a little bit too long of a long game to just run a completely different system because you feel like it. I mean, unless they're just going to do what they do in the regular season and change it from that.
Yeah, and I think there's also the factor of LeBron's awareness level, because sometimes we've seen him not pay attention that much on defense. If he's guarding Kevin Durant, he can't do that. Like, Kevin Durant will cut off the ball and he will get an easy lob for 2 points. He will pop out for a three and take a clean three. And that really changes the dynamic of the Cavs' defense, because if Love's defending the center, like, Zaza isn't, you know, Zaza's not exactly a great offensive player, but he can do some certain things that Love's going to have to pay attention to. Tristan Thompson is going to have to do some serious work on Draymond Green, and how does it impact the Cavs' rebounding? I mean, there's just so many layered questions, but so many of them probably could be solved if LeBron is playing a little bit more engaged on defense and is just paying attention to, you know, Durant and making sure he doesn't get clean cuts to the rim. Because if you make the Warriors work it, you know, they may still get a three with 5 seconds left on the shot clock that they make because they're the freaking Warriors and they can create those looks and they're just so good at shooting. But you'd prefer to have them do that and take your chances that way, I think, than, you know, have Durant get these clean looks to the rim after 10 seconds into the shot clock.
That ties in with something that might be the single most important thing for me when I'm watching this game, is just, it's not about whether they go in or not, but what percentage or what proportion, whatever, of the Warriors' shot attempts are clean looks, are lightly contested, or you know, the guy isn't in the right place or something like that. I don't even particularly care in this context, because it's so long until the playoffs, about how it happens. It's just what that proportion is will be important, because if they're generating open looks, like, let's say it looks like they're playing the Blazers or something, that mm-hmm. could be an issue. Like, if they can generate offense to that level, it'll be significant, not hugely significant, but significant. And if the Cavs bottle them up a little bit, if they, whether that be through effort, through execution, whatever, if they can do that, it will be a little sign that some of the struggles that Cleveland has had defensively, that might be a more understandable part of not caring about the regular season because you're the NBA champions and no one in your conference threatens you.
Yeah, and I think there's nothing the Cavs have seen this year that's going to prepare them for those type of situations. There's nothing they could have seen from the Raptors, nothing they can see from the Celtics, nothing they can see from, you know, Charlotte or whoever, that's really going to prepare them for this. Just so the Locked On Cavs audience knows, can you just explain how good Kevin Durant's been? Because, like, I don't even know if just looking at the stats really does him justice for if people that haven't watched him play enough.
Sure. Durant, if you look at his statistics, it's one of those, you know, very good years, but maybe not best of the best. And so if you think back to the year he won the MVP, you know, that he hasn't been that guy yet. But the most common refrain among Warriors writers, people like me who talk about the team as well, is he hasn't been selfish enough. This is Durant operating in that kind of deferential honeymoon period where you want everybody to like you and you're not really doing your thing. And the first time that really swung was in the Blazers game. He just had a couple of times where he's just like, I'm just taking the shot. And it helped that he was doing a nice job on Mo Harkless, and they were playing a good game. They were also just killing the Blazers, as happened in that game and has happened fairly frequently this year. The biggest difference with Durant is not on the offensive end, it's on the defensive end. And so for the people who watched not only the Western Conference Finals against the Warriors, but in many ways more the Spurs series, it was an actualization of Durant's defensive potential, because he's athletic guy, very smart, and long. And so you're kind of just sitting there going, okay, well, he could be better. You know, he had some tough assignments before that. He talks about that all the time. But he worked as a help defender in those lineups with Ibaka at center and Durant at the four. And he doesn't do it every night. It's kind of more like LeBron, where he'll pick it, well, you know, like one out of every six or seven games, he'll actually engage on that end. But you instantly see how much of a difference that makes. And 1-6, 1-7 is a lot more frequently than it happened last year. So Cleveland could be one of those games. I mean, LeBron has always been a measuring stick for KD, but it's been more about the flashes than everything else. But those flashes are just as good as they've always been.
Yeah, every time I watch the Warriors, I'm just kind of blown away by what he's doing, because it just seems like this is the type of Kevin Durant we've always wanted in some ways. Like the ISO heavy Durant that we saw carry the load in Oklahoma City was amazing, because it was a testament to how good he is as an individual player. Seeing him just kind of unleashed in a way where he doesn't have to do everything and he doesn't have to, you know, just dribble and create his own shot every time, it's just kind of really interesting to watch. and it just makes them so the Warriors so scary. I kind of wonder when or if he would assert himself in that way. You know, like, because Steph never did it. But, like, how much, I guess, is the question. Like, does it go to, like, closer to Oklahoma City, or is it, like, the middle of it, the middle gap?
It's the middle, because I don't think he'll ever be ball dominant in that way when the other guys are on the floor. You know, maybe he'll call for it a couple times, but he can be destructive off ball. It's something that Oklahoma City just didn't have him do that much. Durant, I wrote a piece for The Athletic, and I did a podcast on it too, about how last year he was the most versatile scorer in the league, and he can succeed in a lot of different ways. He's the best isolation guy in the league, in my opinion. He's also great at spotting up and coming off screens and all that kind of stuff. He's a great shooter, and he's a great scorer. The Thunder didn't ask him to do a lot of that stuff, because that's just not the way their system worked. They had Russ, they had KD, they had the personal dynamics of trading off and everything like that. And one thing that's also been really different for the Warriors this year, and I've talked about this lineup, but I wasn't thinking about it kind of as being a combination podcast, is that Durant gets a couple minutes at the beginning of the second quarter and the beginning of the fourth to really be the guy who runs the offense. Sean Livingston is on the floor for those lineups, but Sean Livingston is not initiating the offense. Durant is. And he seems to enjoy it, but it's still not all the way. It's not even that, where he's the only star on the floor. Sometimes, often Clay's on the floor, but Clay is, you know, he's not initiating a lot of the offense.
Yeah,
Durant still, even in those moments, is more of a collaborator than he ever was in Oklahoma City. And it's been striking that even at his most selfish, he's still more unselfish than he was there.
That's really fascinating. And especially because I was shocked the other day, and I don't know if this is still the case, and I guess shocked is maybe too strong of a word. Klay Thompson's leading the Warriors in shot attempts.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was hilarious. I just kind of thought that was hilarious because his quote over the summer.
I can explain that.
Just worked out. Yeah, please do.
Klay Thompson is the only one of the four Warriors stars who is not a great passer. Like, he's gotten better. It's actually been a notable thing over the last couple weeks. He's getting better at lobbing to JaVale McGee. But all the other guys are good passers and willing passers. Klay, if he gets the ball and he's open, he is not overpassing. He's just shooting. That's just the way it is for him. I don't consider that a criticism when you're as good as he is. So when you think about the way that an offense works, is that the Warriors do a lot of ball movement and player movement. It's been one of the staples of Kerr's regime, one of the biggest differences from Mark Jackson. So if any other player, Draymond, Steph, and especially Steph this year, because it seems like he's been a little bit off, that there are times when those guys pass off clean looks. And it can be for the team concept, it can be for, you know, maybe it was they're not feeling it or whatever. Klay is always feeling it. So if he takes that look every time, that's just gonna give him more shots than everybody else, because he gets open a lot, and if 95% of those open plays turn into makes. Also, he's gotten better as a driver, and that's opened up a little bit for him, and he's getting to the line slightly more than before. So it really has benefited Thompson in many ways more than anybody else. From a basketball kind of karma perspective, I think it's helped Durant the most, because Klay's role is basically the same and Durant's entire basketball life has changed. But Klay is the biggest beneficiary because of the open looks. If Draymond was hitting his shots, it would actually probably be him, because teams are just leaving him open above the break all the time. And sometimes he shoots it, sometimes he doesn't. He can do other things with it. But that's also one of the elements with this Warriors team. Like, you brought up the idea, especially because of the 2015 finals, about the Warriors running a lot of pick and rolls. They haven't really done that this year. They didn't do much of it last year either in the playoffs. I attribute a lot of that to just Steph not being right. But they haven't used a ton of that this year. And I don't expect them to against the Cavs in this game. In the playoffs, yeah, we're going to get into a different conversation with Kevin and everybody else. But they can get into situations that look a lot like when Draymond would get the ball after Steph got trapped, because it really functions the same way. You know, the defense is a little bit discombobulated. Nobody's by Draymond, so he just dribbles in and makes a pass. And that's actually been one of the ways that JaVale McGee has been most helped, because JaVale McGee is the only guy on the Warriors who can actually catch that lob. And because Zaza Pachulia is great at many things, he is not great at catching the ball in the paint or finishing in the paint, and the other guys are just a little bit out of it. So David West is not an alley-oop finisher. So I'm going to be excited to see how the Cavs react to those situations, because even if they're generated in a different way, they've dealt with them before.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying about Draymond getting open looks is going to happen in this game, just because I don't think you can have Tristan Thompson continuously follow him out that far. I really don't think you can do it, because it's going to compromise you on the boards, right? Tristan Thompson is a great rebounder, he is not good enough to run in from the 3-point line after contesting a shot and help the Cavs clean up the boards.
It's also a really easy way to get fouls, especially if you're not good at it, because a player who has his intensity and is going for rebounds in that situation when you don't have position can have a nasty penchant for fouls. It's kind of an underappreciated thing of it, but like if you have it on yourself, like I need to be the defensive rebounder, but you're in the wrong spot, it can be problematic.
Yeah, things like that to me are just what I'm looking forward to, because I haven't been able to pick up things like this in other games with the Cavs. It's like I can only say so much about how the Cavs are going to defend the Raptors, because I just don't really see these complicated issues there. This is the team that I think presents just so many issues, and even at 50% of this game, I'm pretty excited about it.
Same here.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Is this your number one game on Christmas Day? Because for me, it's pretty far and away number one.
I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the other games. Like it's a lot of things that could be fun, but we don't know yet. This is one that no matter what, it's going to be interesting. Even if it's not the most exciting game in the world, it's definitely going to be intellectually there. And a lot of the other ones, we'll see. I mean, I'm going to be covering and talking about a couple of the early ones, of course, including this one. But it's a weird year because a lot of times they try to have two headliners, but like the other, like that ABC game is Bulls Spurs. That could be fun. It very well could be, but we legitimately don't know.
Yeah, the only other game that really stands out to me is Bulls Spurs, just because I want to see how the Kawhi stuff works itself out. They're obviously going to have him defend Jimmy Butler, because like you have to have him defend Jimmy Butler. But the last time these two teams played, and as Matt Moore detailed over at CBS, and I think you probably saw this, like they just leave him over there, and he's Kawhi, you know, and it just makes the Spurs' job so much harder. And the Bulls aren't even exactly that good, you know, like their offense is sort of just kind of whatever. But they won that last game by getting Robin Lopez post ups and Dwayne Wade ISOs, and that was enough against the Spurs. I kind of want to see that, because like Celtics Knicks doesn't do a lot for me, because the Knicks aren't exactly, I'm not convinced they're actually good. like Clippers Lakers, you know, no Blake makes that kind of a must win for the Clippers in some ways, but they should still be a lot better. Timberwolves Thunder, I'd be more into it if the Timberwolves had played better so far this year, but they are closing in on that last playoff spot as of we record this, so maybe that's worth it. And plus, it's Cat, it's Wiggins, and it's Russ. So, I guess that's enough.
I think that's probably going to be, unless the Cavs and Warriors engage, that's probably going to be the best game. But I also don't know how much I'm going to learn from it.
Yeah, I don't really think I will learn very much from that game. I almost kind of wish that was Thunder and Houston. Like, I almost wish that was the game.
Well, and those two teams play, those are just fun games, too. Like, that would have been, and they had that crazy one where Patrick Beverley basically made that nice defensive play at the end. But, yeah, they didn't really add a ton of, like, sizzle to these games. But Christmas is always fun, and another reason why I have some hope for this Warriors-Cavs game is that players always get up for it. Like, that's just the way Christmas works. Sometimes they get overly revved up for it, and that is the way that this game gets bigger than just interesting, is if both teams care.
Yeah, and I guarantee, and to bring this back full circle, I guarantee you there's Draymond is probably going to say something about the Cavs' intro. Just based on how he's responded to stuff this year, there's no way that he's going to see the LeBron elbowing stuff or something that happens from the finals that they put back in the clip, because I think they probably will, knowing the Cavs' pregame stash. I think there's probably going to be some blood coming out of that, because it's not going to be a very friendly environment from the guy, because the Cavs are very good at in terms of in-game ops of making the other team kind of feel like they're in the Cavs' domain, and it's just kind of overwhelming. Even when you've seen it 50 times or whatever, the Cavs' in-game stuff is just, it's a lot. And like on TV, I think it conveys. In the arena, it's just like, okay, like this is a lot, Cavs. Like, you need to chill a little bit.
Yeah, well, we're both looking forward to it. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you, Danny.
Thanks again to Chris Manning for taking the time to come on. You can read him at Fear the Sword. You can follow him on Twitter at CWMWrites. That's CWMWrites. And you can, of course, listen to Locked On Cavs. And you should definitely watch the Christmas Day game. It's going to be a blast. We are also doing it for the Twitter NBA show. Nate Duncan and I are going into Twitter headquarters on Christmas Day to do Celtics, Knicks, and then Warriors, Cavs. We are going to, for the Warriors, Cavs game, we're going to do the whole thing, do a halftime show with live questions through Periscope and Twitter, and we are going to do a post-game show, which will probably run about an hour, recapping the game, talking about league news. You can get to that by following Nate on Periscope, or you can basically check out my Twitter, @DannyLarue, and you can see what's going on there. it's going to be a really fun day with all of that. And then, of course, for those of you who have family things, you can also listen to it after the fact. If you check out Nate on Periscope, you can watch replays of it. So you can do that with really any of our Twitter NBA shows. So you can do that. And we're in the process of trying to convert those also to Dunked On Basketball podcasts. You can do it in that way as well. Hope you enjoyed this combination one. Unless something crazy happens, I am not going to record something new on the Pistons game. You never know, though. But so what that means is that the next podcast will be on that big Cavs-Warriors Christmas Day game. If you have any feedback, good, bad, indifferent, you can reach out to me, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com, at Danny LaRue on Twitter, that's DannyLaRueX. If you want to support the show, there are a couple great ways you can do it. You can leave a rating, leave a review on the podcast player of your choosing. You can subscribe and download every episode, which is great to do with my various stuff because the release times and dates can be a little bit sporadic. So if you subscribe, you don't have to rely on a tweet or anything like that. You can just have it in your podcast player whenever it's ready to go. So the other thing you can do, especially considering they were on this episode, is you can check out SeatGeek. You download their free app, and then you use the promo code LOWARRIORS, and they will give you a $20 rebate on your first purchase. I use SeatGeek all the time. I highly encourage you to do the same. You can also check out David Locke's doing great work on Locked On Warriors. I think he had Locked On NBA. I think he had a new podcast that came out today or yesterday, so I haven't listened to it yet. I'm looking forward to it. Josh Lloyd on Locked On Fantasy Basketball. And then if you are an NFL fan, you can listen to the multitude of Locked On NFL ones, Niners, Raiders, everyone else. And you can check that out now that we're getting into the weekend, getting into Sunday, and getting close to really the end of the NFL regular season. So thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.